Chapter 5. What Next? At the end of the 1960s, a book was published that changed the world, The Limits to Growth. Published under the umbrella of the Club of Rome, an affiliation of various scientists, the title became a number one bestseller in all industrialized nations. The then UN Secretary General U. Thant wrote an introduction uniquely in the history of the UN. I do not wish to seem overdramatic, but I can only conclude from the information that is available to me as Secretary General that the members of the United Nations have perhaps 10 years left in which to subordinate their ancient quarrels and launch a global partnership to curb the arms race, to improve the human environment, to defuse the population explosion, and to supply the required momentum to development efforts. If such a global partnership is not forged within the next decade, then I very much fear that the problems I have mentioned will have reached such staggering proportions that they will be beyond our capacity to control. 10 years after the publication of the book, our civilization would be in such a miserable state that the problems would be beyond our capacity to control. How did the UN Secretary General come to make such a devastating statement? He referred to the thoroughly honest scientists of the Club of Rome, who had calculated the models of the future. These models were based on the data available at the time. They were all correct. But there was one factor that was very difficult to calculate: human inventiveness, intelligence, and creativity. Thus, The Limits to Growth became the first fear-inducing title. Every reasonable person had to be concerned about the state of the Earth. Despite knowing about the gaps in their models, the authors wrote, "Given the many approximations and limitations of the world model, there is no point in dwelling glumly on the series of catastrophes it tends to generate." What catastrophes would be generated? There will be a hopeless shortage of land, even before the year 2000, if population growth continues as today. With the current increase in consumption, most of the most important non-renewable raw materials today will be extremely expensive in 100 years, even with the most optimistic assumptions of newly discovered reserves, technical progress, and the use of suitable replacement materials. Such systemic behavior clearly tends towards exceeding the limits to growth and then collapsing. After the well-founded warnings of the Club of Rome, humans had forest decline hammered into them. First the forests, then humans, was one headline. Then bark beetles would eat our trees, and finally acid rain would do the rest. With all these scenarios, I ask myself why we are still alive at all. After all, we have reached 2016 and are swimming in crude oil. The biological time bomb has not exploded. Yet the apocalyptic horror show continues to be promoted. No matter whether we have a rainy or a hot summer, human beings are at fault in either case. Billions of dollars turn into thin air in questionable funds. Silently, angrily, the shaken populace pays up. After all, it wants to stop climate change. As if carbon dioxide had caused climate change in any past. To be clear, thousands of years ago, our Earth suffered repeated climate change, quite clearly verifiable. But at that time, there were neither industrial chimneys nor car emissions, yet there was still climate change. How about other causes for the climate change we are currently suffering? In The Limits to Growth, the scientists note, carbon dioxide dissolves very easily in water. Completely forgotten? Who actually has an interest in placing all of humanity in a state of fear, to tell people things that are not actually true? And even if just a few models are wrong, why is the world press not up in arms about it? Is the world to be prepared to hope for some kind of savior? What has happened to the intelligence of Homo sapiens sapiens, which increasingly floods world politics and increasing numbers of universities, with scientific nonsense like the so-called gender model? Gender? Everyone has heard about it, but few know what it is actually about. The word gender is used to designate the psychological sex of a person in contrast to their biological sex. Is there such a thing as a psychological sex? Yes, a man can feel themselves to be a woman and vice versa. The concept of gender was invented as long ago as 1985 at the UN World Conference on Women in Nairobi and framed in 1995 at the UN World Conference on Women in Beijing. Within the framework of equality between men and women, some women demanded a program to implement gender equality. Meanwhile, gender has grown into a proper world strategy. Gender mainstreaming is even one of the goals of the European Union. But a few fundamentally correct thoughts have turned into feminist world dictate. There are hardly any scientists left who have the moral courage to stand up against gender. One exception is the German professor Ulrich Kutschera of the universities of Kassel and Stanford. In an interview with the German news magazine Focus, Kutschera described gender as an irrational doctrine. With gender, all scientific facts of biology were denied. The gender mainstreaming ideology comes from a radical feminist sect-like esotericism of the 1990s. It is devoid of any scientific basis. The combative professor underpinned his analysis against gender with an outstanding factual book. What is supposed to be so wrong about gender? We are all made the same. There are only unisex people any longer. The biological sex no longer counts for anything. Boys should actually be ashamed to have been born with a penis. The original idea for this nonsense comes from the American professor John Money, 1921 to 2006. He already said in 1955 that all babies were born as gender-neutral unisex beings. In an experiment, he had one of two identical twin brothers, David and Brian Reimer, surgically reassigned as a woman. Although this perverse experiment was a total failure, it is still propagated by the gender supporters as evidence of the unisex idea. Brian committed suicide at the age of 36, David 2 years later. Today, gender is taught at many universities. It is the same as evolutionary theory. Anyone who does not adhere to gender is excluded from the community of reasonable people. God as a male figure is no longer allowed. A court in Portland, Oregon, has granted a person genderlessness. Jamie Shoup, born as a male, wanted to be neither a man nor a woman, neither Mr. nor Ms., but M.X. Shoup. Jamie Shoup is now M.X. Shoup, and M.X. Shoup is waiting for a new ID card in which it will not say male or female, but non-binary, writes the German news magazine Der Spiegel. I suppose next there won't be any rapist or stay-at-home, translator's note, both are masculine nouns in German, either. After all, we are all gender-neutral. "These Romans are crazy," was a catchphrase in Asterix. These people are crazy, we should say, and although millions of Earth citizens worldwide, including no doubt many scientists, are of the same opinion as myself, hardly any of it gets out. What is wrong with our media, with our sharp and alert journalists? Have they all gone to sleep, or is there a higher power somewhere that suppresses any critical questioning? The problem lies in the poison that is ideologies. They have the same effect as dictatorial religions, and anyone who in a given geographical area thinks differently from what happens to be the ruling religion will be denigrated. Anything that is not left-wing thought is populism, misanthropic, and regressive for the left. And anything that is not right-wing thought is a betrayal of the nation, hypocritical and mendacious for the right. No decent right-winger will attend an event of a left-wing politician, and vice versa. The dogmatists reign supreme. Everyone wants to be rational and be with other rational people. Irrationality means exposing oneself to ridicule, and no one wants that. Now, and this is a truism, every newspaper, every magazine, every TV station has an owner. It may be a rich family, an individual person, a political grouping, a trade union, or the state. Everything belongs to someone. Each owner wants to belong to the rational people in their trade. If a journalist wanted to put something irrational into their paper, they wouldn't get it past their editor. If they did, they would soon be out of a job. We don't have to conjure up conspiracy theories to recognize this behavior of people. What is lacking is moral courage, and anyone who has it is excluded. The same applies with regard to the puppet theater of the so-called broadcasting councils. What was that about the extraterrestrials from the future in the first chapter? All of them beautiful people with sparkling white teeth, soft, kissable lips, and a delicate body, but no distinction between men and women could be identified. In May 2016, 160 people came to a meeting at the Harvard Medical School in Boston for an exchange of views, which was originally meant to be kept secret. They discussed the question of the artificial human genome. Will we be able to produce humans with specific characteristics in the future? The question is ethically highly controversial, because when humans can create specific humans, they are playing at being God. And they will do so, at some point, just like the ETs have done. On June 28, 2016, Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, gave a remarkable speech to the European Parliament. It was about the departure of Great Britain from the European Union, so-called Brexit. Juncker showed his concern and said, "Make no mistake, those who are watching us from afar are concerned. I have met and listened to several leaders from other planets. They are very worried because they are wondering about the course the European Union will take. So we must reassure Europeans and those who are watching us from further away." The media interpreted Juncker's words, "several leaders from other planets," as a translation error or slip of the tongue. Not so. Juncker gave his speech in French. The word pays, country, and planet, are very different. Furthermore, the explanation of a slip of the tongue does not fit into the context of the text. I speak French and do not need a translator. Juncker continued, "et ceux que nous observent de plus loin," which means, "and those who observe us from further away." Now, Mr. Juncker should be given the benefit of the doubt that he was tired and annoyed by some hecklers. The questions must nevertheless be permitted. Is he aware of contact with extraterrestrials? Is it really due to tiredness that his brain no longer kept things apart? And what makes me personally sit up and pay attention? The whole passage was removed from the official text of the Juncker speech. Censorship. But why in the world would extraterrestrials be worried about the cohesion of Europe? Why would they remotely care about that? We can speculate. Presumably, ETs want to conclude their treaties with a united Earth. Europe is one piece of the puzzle. We must all be the same. Irrespective of such curiosities, humans are moving in an irreversible direction prescribed by computer technology and the inevitable arrival of artificial intelligence, AI. The meanwhile retired Professor Edward Fredkin, physicist, Boston University, MIT, and Caltech, is convinced that the electrons whizzing around the atomic nucleus, constantly exchanging information with other electrons, are based on something like binary code. The whole universe, says Fredkin, is ruled by some program, just like in the model of God as a universal computer or God as a mathematical formula. What is life? Asks Fredkin. What is consciousness? What is thinking, memory, and those things? Fredkin recognizes in our DNA, which is passed on from generation to generation, nothing other than digitally encoded information. From the beginning, this information contains the answer to our development as a life form. Whether DNA turns into a plant, which one, or an animal, which one, is determined from the beginning. The electron is nothing other than a part of the answer. Somewhere out there, Fredkin says, there exists a machine-like thing that controls the laws of the universe. This machine-like thing controls the extraterrestrials, and they, in turn, control us. For years, brain researchers have repeatedly tried to pin down the miracle of God. Where does the power of faith come from? It should be possible to show it in our gray cells, after all. Scientific experiments in a new discipline, neurotheology, have shown God is located in the brain. Those who are willing to engage in inner contemplation manage it. Those who lack faith will not be helped by a magnetic field either. The desire for something divine produces sublime feelings in the brain, yet God, as a being, cannot be found. Looking for God in the brain is like opening up the television to find the newsreader. The fact that the brain can produce an elevated feeling of God does not mean that God, as a being, can be found. Electrons speeding around the atomic nucleus and exchanging their information with other electrons are not measurable, and placing a whole brain under a scanning electron microscope is not technically feasible. But in order to experience the elevated feeling of being in connection with some being of God requires the desire to experience just such a feeling. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Where does the desire come from? Our brain is, after all, a product of DNA, and the latter of the cell. This, in turn, consists of millions of atoms, and the extraordinary electrons orbit each atom. The DNA is where the information is stored, which provides the data for the development of that precise form of life. This information exists before any life form even begins to grow. The 21st century will be the century of the technology of consciousness. No one can dispute the evolution of computers. After all, they are becoming ever more sophisticated with each generation. Computers will grow into units that program themselves. One of the leading lights in the computer industry, Dr. Raymond Kurzweil, is convinced that by 2045, at the latest, artificial intelligence will make humans superfluous. He calls that singularity. The artificial intelligence of the future would behave in such a way toward humans that we would not even notice how intelligent computers are. Humans would not be able to notice it in any case because they simply lack the intelligence. We would be too stupid for that. Some prospect. If the future of human beings no longer consists of anything but artificial intelligence, why then are humans necessary at all? And why extraterrestrials? And why is it necessary for the human species to be influenced by extraterrestrials today if we will no longer exist in the year XYZ anyway? Will there perhaps be super-fast computers communicating with one another and doing so faster than the speed of light and from star to star without us knowing about it? Is artificial intelligence perhaps developing a language that is incomprehensible to us? Or will artificial intelligence in the future take human form again for some reason to multiply more easily? In Greek mythology, Pandora was the first woman. The father of the gods, Zeus, gave her a box with the command to give the box to human beings, but the box must not be opened under any circumstances. Zeus, of course, knew that human curiosity would lead to Pandora's box being opened. We have long opened the box. This is the opinion of the Japanese billionaire and cybernetics pioneer Yoshiyuki Sankai. In an interview with the newspaper Die Welt, he asserted, "Development is already very advanced. Learning, artificial intelligence, is already in military use in a very advanced form. Combat robots on four legs can climb up mountains, can carry biological and chemical weapons, and select their targets autonomously." Yoshiyuki Sankai notes with some resignation that we humans were the sole living beings who could override natural selection. Correction, dear Mr. Yoshiyuki Sankai, extraterrestrials have been doing that for a long time. How did we conceive of the idea of artificial intelligence in the first place? The idea has been stalking through science fiction literature since time immemorial, but it became official on April 17, 1990. That is when the American, Dr. Marvin Lee Minsky, 1927 to 2016, professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, received the prize of the Science and Technology Foundation of Japan. He received it expressly for his concept of artificial intelligence. The prize was presented to him in the National Theater of Tokyo in the presence of the Japanese imperial couple. Marvin Minsky had started studying the abilities of our brain as a young man and had raised the question, if the brain is a kind of machine, and if consciousness only arises because electrons and neurons are whizzing about causing an effect, then it should be possible to bring about the same effect artificially. Here, crucial differences between a brain and a computer very quickly became apparent. Our brain functions because about 100 billion neurons exchange messengers between one another and create a cognitive system through these connections, the so-called synapses. Because each nerve cell can pass on hundreds of contacts, a neural network is created in the human brain of up to 100 billion connections. The crucial factor here is that these neurons function as a network, while with a computer the commands are executed consecutively. This is the critical difference. The steps in the computer were programmed beforehand. Be it by humans or computers, AI is irrelevant. The computer performs calculations, even if at lightning speed. The brain, in contrast, has the complete overview. How does that work? When our eyes see a mountain landscape, or our grandmother, they know in an instant what it is. Our brain does not have to do the calculation. We can also drive a car, pay attention to everything on the road, speak with our passenger, listen to music, analyze an unpleasant smell, admire the mountain landscape, and think about sex. We can do all of these things, and a lot more, simultaneously. In his brochure, Auf dem Weg zu Intelligenzen Systemen, On the Way to Intelligent Systems, Professor Rolf Pfeiffer of the Department of Informatics at the University of Zurich points to a paradox. A chess master, Dr. Pfeiffer says, can remember about 50,000 moves that they can call up in seconds. The more a chess master knows, the faster the identification of moves. In a computer program, in contrast, the time for finding a specific move increases the more possible moves are entered. Human memory behaves in exactly the opposite way. The more it knows, the faster it can find specific information. The phenomenon was known as the expert paradox. Then, in March 2016, the British neuroscientist Demis Hassabis programmed a self-learning computer with the software AlphaGo. The game Go is considered to be incredibly complex. 30 million moves were entered. And lo and behold, the computer beat the best Go player, the South Korean Lee Sedol. A total of 5 games were played. AlphaGo won 4 of them. Beforehand, the computer, with its program, had played innumerable times against itself, and in doing so, constantly reprogrammed and improved itself. That is called a learning artificial intelligence. Will we humans, therefore, soon be duped by AI? And are the ETs out there who influence our history and observe us nothing other than artificial intelligence? It cannot be ruled out. Yet our brain is so much more sophisticated than the program AlphaGo, because each human being is unique, but each artificial intelligence is not. Excuse me? The human brain is constantly programmed from birth. That can be shown with an example. Before birth, every infant lay in the pleasant warmth of the womb. Let us call what they experienced there pleasure. No sooner born, and the baby begins to cry. It feels the opposite of pleasure, that is, unpleasure. The infant wants food, they scream, equivalent to unpleasure. The breast or bottle is given, equals pleasure. The infant gripes, is tired, wants company. This corresponds to the feeling of unpleasure. Then familiar faces appear, and the child hears, blah, 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 they are stroked, have their nappies changed, equals pleasure. A few years later, the child is taught what they are and are not allowed to do. The child has their own first experiences. They fall over, cut, or burn themselves. All of it unpleasure. The parents teach them which of the neighbors are nice and which ones aren't. Pleasure, unpleasure. A few more years later, the child has started going to school. Every time they understand something or are praised, they register as pleasure. The opposites, bad pupil, as unpleasure. Purity follows. The first discoveries relating to their own body, the fervor of love, the rage of jealousy. Harmony, the happiness of togetherness, disappointment, the pain of separation, and so on. Everything is stored in the brain as pleasure and unpleasure. Now these experiences relate to all of us, so are we all the same, after all? 10 people of the same age sit in the same cinema, breathe the same air, see the same film. Among the 10, there is a couple in love, holding hands. Someone else is restless, something is bothering him. Another is constantly comparing the action with another film in her mind. One person likes the actors, another finds them silly. One is afraid of the end, the other cannot wait for it. The dialogue is terrible, one complains. The other person feels himself as the main protagonist in a heroic scene, and so on, ad infinitum. The same applies to every human action. 20 people experience the campfire, smell the scent of the wood, see the thunderstorm coming, but each one registers the course of events differently, connects it with different memories. 50,000 people in a football stadium, 300 in church, 1,000 at a political event, all of them experience something in common, the stadium, the teams, the uniting political or religious idea. Despite the many commonalities, each one has different thoughts, emotions, memories. About 100 billion neurons exchange messengers in the human brain and create an extraordinary cognitive system through their synapses. But because every nerve cell is known to pass on hundreds of contacts, the neural network comprises 100 trillion connections. That number is not nearly enough. All people experience their senses differently. The taste of charcoal, rosemary, nutmeg, or the feeling of a lover's skin is absorbed differently by each person. Stroking, pressure on a part of the body, a kick in the groin, or a fist in the face are all different. Every human eye sees different things. The ears of a musician hear different details from mine. This makes each person unique, scientifically easy to prove. 8 billion people live on the globe, but not one has the same fingerprint as their neighbor. The same is true of the genetic code. Each person is distinctive. And this also makes clear that the constant attempts of clever political men to make us all the same will forever remain an illusion. If we were all identical, no extraterrestrial intelligence would bother with us. Because each one would be the same as their neighbor, contact with a single human being would be sufficient. Humanity would not be of interest. But now we are units that multiply with pleasure. Sex means the greatest pleasure. Then we collect information for a lifetime and pass it on through electrons. The ETs out there are dependent on our diversity. Artificial intelligence can program itself, can learn to solve highly complex mathematical tasks in fractions of a second, but it has no emotion. We may now design robots that start to cry when they see something sad, or others that stroke patients. I can easily imagine kissing and copulating robots that look like humans, act like humans, and smell like them, but they have no spirit. There will never be spirit born from software, and that is not a question of technical development, but an a priori impossibility, says David Gelernter, professor of computer science at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Our spirit is not static. It changes constantly, not just in the course of our life, but even during a day. That is what comprises the uniqueness of each person. It is not just a matter of thoughts that a computer may be able to reproduce. It is a matter of the memories, feelings, emotions, words, and sounds that together comprise the spirit. This spirit cannot be confined. Information can be. Have the extraterrestrials somewhere stored a piece of information for us, ready to be called up? Where would we have to look? All large organizations have stores of their knowledge. Examples. In the Second World War, the Swiss blasted tunnels and large chambers into their mountains. Subterranean barracks and hospitals were built. Ammunition depots, sleeping quarters, ventilation shafts, and whole cable car systems were anchored in the granite. Today, many of these caverns, which could resist a nuclear attack, have been rented to companies on a long-term basis. That is where the knowledge of the company concerned is stored. All the world's seeds are stored in Norway's Spitsbergen, about 1 million seed samples from potatoes, rice, wheat, grasses, and maize, to every conceivable flower and crop plant. The facility, called Doomsday Seed Vault, lies in the Arctic and guarantees secure cooling even in the event of a power failure. The Mormon Church, with its headquarters in Salt Lake City, has for decades registered all available data of humanity. About 4 billion records, such as first and last names, genealogical information, and family history of both sexes, and so on, are stored in the so-called Granite Mountain Records Vault. The Mormon Church does not seek to keep its register secret. Everyone can find out about their family history there. The Church of Scientology operates a vast bunker system under the desert of New Mexico, between Santa Fe and Amarillo, New Mexico, the Trementina base. It contains 140 tons of books, writings, and steel tablets, as well as more than 2,000 titanium capsules with computer data. The point on the ground in the desert under which the mighty archive is stored is marked on the surface by a symbol that can only be seen from the air. Two intersecting circles with a diamond in the center of each, just like the pictures in the cornfields. Documents of all kinds have been stored for centuries under the walls of the Vatican in Rome, the Archivo Segreto Vaticano, the Secret Vatican Archive. Alongside ancient writings from various countries, the records of the proceedings in the witch hunts, as well as of papal policy during the Nazi period, are stored here. And, of course, documents about the contact with extraterrestrials. Fatima says hello. Where are the archives of the ETs? Are there any kind of extraterrestrial legacies on Earth? Enoch, who was instructed by the ETs thousands of years ago, told his son before his departure into space, "And now, my son Methuselah, I have revealed everything to you and given you the books which concern all these things. Preserve, my son Methuselah, the books from your father's hand, and give them to the coming generations of this world." Book of Enoch, chapter 81, verse 10. Now the Arab historian Ahmad al-Makrizi, circa 1300 AD, who cites the ancient Egyptian sources in his work Kitet, assures us that the Great Pyramid had been built before the flood. By whom? By the same Enoch. And this Mr. al-Makrizi is not making things up, because he fastidiously lists all Enoch's forebears up to the patriarch Adam. He also writes that the pyramid contained books about all secret sciences. Furthermore, the treasures of the stars, a mighty quantity. In fact, ever more shafts and chambers have been located in and under the Great Pyramid in recent years, using the most modern measuring techniques. None of these chambers can be entered. The chimneys leading to them are too narrow to crawl through, which throws a clear light on the planning engineers of the time, who did not exist at the time of Cheops. I, for my part, would not be surprised if books from Enoch with the messages from the ETs were found in the chambers. I have reported previously about Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey, which is thought to be 11,500 years old. I know from a reliable source that the place is at least 10 times bigger than generally published. Further excavations are deliberately not being undertaken. After all, something unexpected might come to light. A similar thing applies with regard to Gunung Parang. It lies in Java, 50 kilometers southeast of the city of Cianjur, and is said to be at least 14,000 years old. C14 dating of human bones found within the site even produced an age of 20,000 years. No matter which age is correct, one way or another, Gunung Padang would be older than the Great Pyramid near Cairo, at least according to the dating of Egyptology. Gunung Padang lies 890 meters above sea level and consists of several hills with terraces, including some of the hard plutonic rite andesite, hardness 8 according to the Mohn scale. Then there are walls of many thousands of basalt columns. The site is reminiscent of Nan Madol on the island of Pohnpei in the Caroline Islands, Micronesia. Here, too, more than 100,000 basalt columns were used for building, and no one to the present day knows by whom or for what purpose. In Gunung Padang, there are a number of curiosities. Magnetic irregularities are registered, and in certain spots, the compass keeps spinning. Measurements using geoelectrics and georadar show spaces deep below the site. Gunung Padang means Mountain of Light in the local language, and the place has been a sacred heavenly site for the indigenous peoples for thousands of years. Who knows what messages will appear beneath it? The whole thing is a time capsule, write the authors Vantari and Mumford in the magazine Nexus. Time capsules from the ETs, prepared thousands of years ago for us people of the present time? Why bother if they are here anyway and could inform us at first hand? With their messages from the past, they could prove to us, eternal doubters and disbelievers, it was us who founded your civilization. We brought about positive mutations in your evolution. We controlled development, carefully, but steadily. It is possible that writings will be discovered in an ancient structure that explain everything. It is possible also that the time capsule has been orbiting our Earth since Odin's time and is only waiting to be collected by a spacefaring generation. It is possible, furthermore, that a von Neumann probe has been orbiting in our solar system for thousands of years. What are von Neumann probes? Johann von Neumann, 1903 to 1957, was a brilliant mathematician. He developed the idea of a miniature robot that can keep replicating itself. It works like this. In the search for a suitable planet, a small probe is sent into space. As soon as the machine has found an inhabited planet, it remains orbiting in the respective solar system, but at the same time produces a copy of itself. The copy, in turn, continues its flight. When another inhabited planet is found, the process repeats itself. The probes reproduce themselves like cells. The time comes when there are millions of von Neumann probes flying around a galaxy. All of them collect data that they send home, wherever that may be. Are such extraterrestrial probes flying around our locality as well? On November 6, 1991, the astronomer Jim Scotti from Arizona's Kitt Peak Observatory discovered a small object in our solar system. It was given the designation 1991 VG. It was thought to be a mini-asteroid, and large telescopes were pointed at it. But the strange object out there reflected the sunlight in different colors. It had to be something artificial, probably a burnt-out rocket stage. Precise calculations of its trajectory produced the result that the alien object had already passed near the Earth in 1958 and 1972. In other words, before we started traveling in space. The Australian astronomer Duncan Steele asked the question as long ago as 1995 whether this might be an alien von Neumann probe. We will receive an answer at the earliest in the summer of 2017, when the thing will go racing past us again. We will very soon be able to document the visit of extraterrestrials, also without probes and time capsules. Increasing numbers of curious formations keep appearing on the surface of Mars that do not quite fit into the picture of a natural explanation. Enthusiasts who spend months sifting through the official NASA pictures from Mars have found pyramid-like structures, as well as rectangular obelisks reaching into the sky, and triangular blocks with the same side lengths. In addition, the riddles surrounding the moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, have still not been solved. The NASA probe Dawn, which flew past the mini-planet Ceres in the asteroid belt, provided curious images of a pyramid-like mountain with black and white scratches, shiny white spots, and rectangular and square formations. As with all information that could turn our worldview on its head, such evidence disappears very quickly from screens. The NASA photos are publicly accessible, but revealing pictures keep dematerializing into a hole of non-existence. An old guard is at work on Earth that is attempting to sweep all discoveries about ETs in our solar system under the carpet and make them appear ridiculous. A pointless exercise, my friends from the other side. Despite diligent censorship, such knowledge can no longer be stopped. The messages cannot be ignored. Pandora's box can no longer be closed. The British astrobiologist Professor Milton Wainwright from the universities of Sheffield and Buckingham has discovered organic substances from space at a height of 40 kilometers. The particles definitively do not exist on Earth. "The organisms must come from space," he told the British newspaper The Daily Mail. "We found evidence that the DNA is not from Earth. If our organisms came from Earth, they must be contaminated with DNA from Earth, and they are not." Really, such a report from the kitchen of a thoroughly honest scientist should have gone around the world as a sensation. It was rapidly stifled. Mr. Nick Pope worked for the British Defense Ministry for 21 years. There he was responsible both for the secret UFO files and those that were subsequently released for public access. "I have known Nick for many years and value not just his British humor, but also his serious analyses. It is to him that I owe sight of the files of the British Defense Ministry entitled Global Strategic Trends Out to 2045. The document is 172 pages long, and alongside the military future, also deals with other aspects." Nick Pope says, "As things stand at present, computer knowledge doubles every 3 years. In 2023, certain computers will catch up with the human brain, and in 2045, they could be 100,000 times more effective. Could true artificial intelligence be possible one day soon, with science fiction become science fact?" We human beings have grown up on our world. The evolutionists are right, but not completely. The Earth was never a closed system. Throughout its developmental history, there were always special, artificial mutations. It can be shown in the human genome. It can be shown in our traditions. Now a study group at the ETH Zurich, Zurich University of Science and Technology, has found that data can be fed into the DNA and subsequently read without error, stored for all eternity. There is no point in trying to deflect humanity from the path of knowledge. The evidence that human beings have been influenced by extraterrestrials throughout history to the present day is becoming more compelling by the day. In the longer term, the anti-ET lobby doesn't stand a chance in any case. The message also resides in the DNA, in each of us, and it is passed on from one generation to the next. We would do well to come to terms with the presence of ETs. Then the shock will be avoided. Postscript. Roger flinched as the flickering started again on the floor of his living room. Nothing had happened for 3.5 months. Roger tripped over a stool, slid on his knees, and stared in surprise at an algebraic formula floating above the floor. Agitatedly, he phoned his son. "Take a photo of the thing, quickly, Dad, before it disappears." "Reminds me of the Schrödinger equation," Peter Zwicky said slowly.
"Of what?"
"Erwin Schrödinger, Austrian physicist, lived from 1887 to 1961. He received the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1933. About 1926, he presented an equation that is the foundation of quantum physics, E equals P squared over 2m plus VRT.
"And what does this equation prove?" Roger Sr. wanted to know.
"In principle, the Schrödinger equation is a wave equation. It shows the change of a state over time through its energy. Ever heard of Schrödinger's cat? The cat which is simultaneously both alive and dead. As a result of the Schrödinger equation, our colleague Max Tegmark proved the multiverse. Everything is everywhere and can be simultaneously. Those there, 107 years in the future, who have sent us this message are indicating that the future is always with us. No matter what we do rightly or wrongly today, the future happens regardless."
This concludes the reading of The Gods Never Left Us, the long-awaited sequel to the worldwide bestseller Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Däniken. Copyright 2018 by Eric von Däniken. This book was read by Sean Renette. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Career Press and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.